anybody who's done any sort of like big campaign or anything like that, like you spend months internally like working on it and doing it and all this stuff. And then when you launch it, the last thing you want to talk about, think about, or speak about is that campaign. You're like ready to move on, and your audience hasn't heard a thing about it yet.
So I want to talk about something that I've been talking very loud about, which is that you're probably making more content than you need.
So true.
And probably getting way less out of it than you should. So Justin Simon has built an entire system for turning one idea into a month's worth of content.
That's a lot of content.
It's a lot of content, a lot of content. He's the creator of what he calls the distribution first approach. He's a former head of content at, let's see, at TechSmith and Metadata.io. And it got me thinking about this. I think it is easy actually to kind of fill your time just making content, feeling like, oh, I'm busy, I'm doing good stuff. But is it the right stuff? Is it the right content? So this is going to be an interesting one. And when I say one, I mean episode, because I'm Chris Savage, the CEO of Wistia, and this is Talking to Loud, the show where we serve up the loudest takes on building businesses, top-notch products, and unforgettable brands. And we're going to do it again right now with Justin Simon. Before we get into all the systems and frameworks of content repurposing and distribution, I'm curious. So what's the first piece of content you ever made that got you talking too loud, aka what you're proud of?
Oh, man, that is... There's been so many. The first one that I'm really proud of, I would say the first one that I was really, really proud of was when I was... leading content at Metadata, we did a full-on original podcast. It was the pillar of the entire content strategy. And I was just I was the only content person, marketer of three. And it was like, how do we do a show in a way that's unique and interesting and fun? And it was pre sort of everybody doing a podcast. But we did a co-hosted show, which was super rare at the time, and was able to really pull together everything we were doing inside of the company, product releases, et cetera, and do it in a more natural way. And how do we talk about that and create content in a way that is not boring? And so I would say that was probably my most proud moment of creating content, was because we were able to, it wasn't like we were going into the show and like, what keywords are you know, most popular in SEMrush, and how do we are just like, here's the problems we hear from our customers. Here are the things that we're releasing and the problems that are around that. Just talk about it. Let's just talk about the problems and the issues. You know, and we ended up over the first 6 months getting, I think, close to 25,000 downloads on that show. And it was just like wild for a B2B show, you know?
That's amazing.
That's amazing. Jinx.
Jinx.
Super amazing.
Super amazing. Is that what brought you into thinking about really like repurposing from, was it from that, or was it something else?
I think that role is what sort of forced my hand as far as repurposing goes. I had started doing some of that in previous roles when I was at TechSmith running content there, but I had a content team of like 10 people with interns. So, you know, you can kind of get by because there's so many different people and so many different things we were creating. Then you shrink me down and I'm the content person, team of one, and we still need to look like we're doing the amount of work that we had with 10 people. And this was pre-AI or pre anything like that. So I was like, how the heck do we scale in a way that's reasonable for a person working a decent amount of hours and trying to stay sane? And really the flip there was, how do I do that in a proactive way instead of a reactive way?
That's awesome. You've built this whole distribution first philosophy. How do you explain it to someone who's never heard it before?
How I would describe distribution first is simply thinking of distribution ahead of creating your content. you thought you knew what I was going to say. So thinking distribution first is thinking distribution first. It's putting distribution ahead of your content creation efforts. So in the typical B2B marketing land that we live in, we focus 95% of our efforts on creating content. So outlining and ideation and writing and editing, and then we hit publish, and then we can like take a breath and we're like, oh my gosh, yes, thank God I we got the thing done. And really that's at that point that does, the marketing hasn't even begun because nobody even knows this thing exists. And I think that's where, you know, we tend to really struggle. And so the idea behind distribution first is like, let's throw distribution at the front end of it. Like, let's know where we're going to even share this thing. How are we going to promote this? Where, who is going to see this? Because the landscape has changed so much in the last 5 years, but there was certainly a time that I remember, and I sort of forget it because it's not this way really anymore, but you would just write things and the assumption would be, well, Google will pick it up and then people will find it. Like, because everything was so Google centric as far as search engine goes, that it was just like, cool, we'll write it in Google and it's all going to kind of go in the wash and Google does its thing. And, you know, we have no control over our lives. We just got to hope Google picks it up and we're good to go. That slowly has died over the last decade. And really, it started a shift in my mind. I forget which stat I saw, but it was like 90% of what you create never even shows up in Google. And that stat just blew my mind in terms of like, oh my gosh, my team is spending all their time creating content and 90% of it won't even show up. And that really shifted my mindset to be like, okay, cool. How do we almost guarantee in a way that we can get eyeballs on this content one way or the other?
It's crazy how much the game has changed, where we used to just be able to publish and it would be seen and you would get traffic, and it doesn't work like that anymore.
No, it's almost the exact opposite, which I think makes marketers and businesses super uncomfortable, which is this idea of like, you actually have to do good content now. You can't just like, I can't just look up a keyword set and load junk content in, or I can't just assume this is what my audience cares about. I have to actually know what they care about. I have to actually make good content. It's a totally different world, but it's an exciting one.
Have you heard this term of like interest media instead of social media?
No, that's new.
Yeah. I think the idea is like that social media was, you would follow people that you know and you would see stuff from them. So like, I follow Justin, I see more Justin stuff. But now, because so much of our feeds are actually just like what the network thinks we're going to be interested in, that it's actually about like what your interests are. And so it's this next level shift. It's like the TikTokification of everything.
Yes. Yes.
Which is so different than how it used to be. And also, I think like potentially creates a lot of opportunity because you don't have to spend years building a following. If you have remarkable content that is for someone's interest, they will see it, is the idea. But it's yet another huge change that especially B2B, which likes predictability, a lot of the predictability goes away.
Yeah, almost all the predictability goes away, which is sort of the bummer. Like even for individual creators who have, you know, I've spent a decent amount of time creating stuff on the internet, and you're right, it's completely changed on what that looks like, even for the people that I'm following. And I think it's why things like, you're seeing Substack sort of start to take off. I think newsletters are starting to, like, because I think there's still a longing to like, dang it, I like Chris's stuff. I want to see what Chris has got to say. I don't just want, like, my LinkedIn feed is almost becoming just a graveyard of sludge. Like, I don't care about any of these people, or if they are people, or you know, like who is this? And so I think for me, it's going to be interesting to see where the pendulum goes, as like you mentioned, TikTok and all those have really shifted how people consume content. But at the end of the day, there are still times where, hey, I really like that creator's content, that business's content. I would like to see what they have to say.
Yeah, I think it is going to create even more demand on those channels where you know you're going to be able to get what you're saying you want to get. So it's funny how these things come in cycles. I feel like that's where we started and then gone away to something else and then like right back to that too. Okay, let's talk about your 3C content framework: Cornerstone, Core, and Cut. So can you walk me through each of those as, and maybe with an example?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can sort of think of this as a triangle, with Cornerstone being at the top and then working down to the point of Cornerstone being wide and broad, and Core content sort of being at the core in the middle of that triangle, and then Cut content being kind of small and at the bottom. And that triangle can reverse itself, and I'll sort of describe that. But Cornerstone content, think of yearly, quarterly, or sort of even biannual types of content. So really the pillars of what your company is creating things around. So for us at metadata. It was a benchmark study report that we had where we had all of this data, you know, from our own platform. We'd pull it all in, we'd create this benchmark report. And what typically happens at a company is you would create that report. There'd be a lot of push toward it. Maybe you're releasing it in the spring. You talk about it, you know, for a month or so in the spring, and then you'd never mention that thing again as long as you lived. And so what we did actually was try to be very proactive in terms of what types of content are coming out of this benchmark report and plotting that along the lines to say, okay, how do we talk about this in some way, shape, or form every single month? That might be tangentially as a blog post that's then sort of like just leading back to those main ideas and linking to it. That could be several LinkedIn posts. It could be a podcast episode. We're going to drop all the data. And then another podcast episode, we're going to drop specific data around a specific channel, those type of things. And so I think to me, that's where Cornerstone Core and Cut Content fit in. Whereas core content would be much more those weekly rhythms, that podcast, the blogs, and then cut content being the social aspect of that, or email, just smaller little micro bits of content. And so why I think it's so impactful to have cornerstone content is because you don't have to reinvent the wheel all the time. You can just slot those things in where it makes sense. So like I mentioned with the benchmark report, you've got maybe 6 or 7 subtopics in there. That gives you basically your guardrails to be able to create your blogs and your podcasts off of. And then once you create all that content, you can repurpose those into social cuts, emails, et cetera. And so you have this big triangle of content that you can pull from.
Yeah, I love that for a bunch of reasons. Like, I think it's obviously a framework that someone can use. It's going to make it easier to figure out what content to make. But also, I think we put so much effort into those big cornerstone pieces. And the truth is that everyone's just busy. So like, even if you like signed up for the report, went to the webinar, you might've been doing something else the webinar was on. You might've signed up for the report. Most people are not combing through every detail and saying, I'm going to change what I'm doing based on these details. So if you see something else about a very specific thing you can do based on something from the report, that is very actionable. And so it's actually also helping to understand like that a lot of that content is much more valuable than it even seems. Like, just because you can release it once doesn't mean that you should be done paying attention to it.
Totally. And I sort of think about these things as in two different ways. There's micro repurposing and macro repurposing. So micro repurposing is, I think, what everybody thinks of when they think of repurposing. You're going to take this podcast video and you're going to turn it into a podcast clip. Okay, cool. Everybody understands sort of that one-to-one. Macro repurposing to me is ideas. And that's what I think where the real money is in repurposing is I've got these core ideas, these perceptions, these points of view within that cornerstone piece of content that I want to change how you think about the industry. I want to change how you think about these things. And so you're not only just sharing out and being able to drip those things, those little pieces of content out. What you're ultimately trying to do is change how people think, what they think about you, how they think about the industry, how they think about how they're doing their work, all of those type of things. And so if you can, and then really big picture, if you're thinking about, okay, at the end of the year, I want my customers to say Wistia equals XYZ. All right, cool. That's what we want. Now we get to reverse engineer all of our content plan off of that. What types of pillars, what types of cornerstone content do we need to create to even make that a reality? And now you're starting to tie your content back to actual business outcomes that you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. And I think just because you've been on something for 6 months does not mean that your customer has, or 6 years. You know, it just depends on the day that they've decided to solve the problem, the day that they've decided to like research on a topic, right? And so that's the other reason why having content like this that can live on is so valuable, because like you're giving it more of a chance to actually like hit and resonate, because you can't control when people are actually ready to buy, like when they're in market.
Nope. I've been talking about, you mentioned the 3C content method. I've been talking about the 3C content method since 2021, so 4 years. And I just posted about it a couple of weeks ago. One of the best posts I've had all year. You know, it's like,
that's what happens.
Yeah.
If you're not someone who's making the content, but just experiencing it, I think it's easy to see that one post, be like, wow, cool new idea. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. And you know it way better than your audience. You're in it all the time. I think that's why I sort of laughed about like the typical way people do content marketing, because I've been in these rooms where if anybody who's done any sort of like big campaign or anything like that, like you spend months internally like working on it and doing it and all this stuff. And then when you launch it, the last thing you want to talk about, think about, or speak about is that campaign. You're like ready to move on, and your audience hasn't heard a thing about it yet.
That's right. Yeah. And I think like you're annoyed because you've heard it 50 times or 1,000 times, and they might hear it once, but for it to have an impact, they might need to hear it 10. And I think it's this like persistence thing that really matters. And it's, I don't know, it's funny. When you're talking about this, it makes me think actually about internal company messaging, where we've learned we have to say the same thing over and over and over. And if you say it once, people are like, okay, are they really on this? You say it again, okay. And once you say it the 10th time or the 20th time or the 50th time, if people can really repeat it, then they're like, oh, they really believe it. And so like now I understand that I should act on this. But it's the same thing with any type of messaging. It's just amazing sometimes how often you need to hear a message for it to resonate.
Yeah, I can't remember the number that I heard, but it's at least 8, and it's probably way more than that before that message is actually going to stick. And so when you think about that, and we have these internal discussions a lot too, where, you know, how often do we talk about X, Y, and Z thing? And it's like, really, like you kind of have to overswing that. I think you overswing the pendulum on messaging and repeating yourself, because even though we post that same message or topic every single week, that is in a flood of somebody's feed. They're not consuming that content in that same way. They don't understand. They might just see it. And again, it's that seeing it and seeing it and seeing it, even just in those little micro bursts of like, oh, X equals Y. Awesome.
Yeah. There's some guy on TikTok, and he's British, and he starts recording two people walk, or a couple people walk up to him, and he says, hey, can you record a quick video for me? The camera's already on. And they're like, okay. And then he turns and he like basically jump scares them. So he like jumps at them, and then they laugh. And often he jump scares again. And then he goes and acts like a robot. And then he does some little spiel, and then he tries to do a backflip. And it's the same exact thing. And somehow that makes it more compelling every time you see it. It's like, this guy's a lunatic that he's doing it this much, but he's clearly found that this works. And this has nothing to do with telling a great message, but I just,
we're going to say consistency, man. That's what we're going
to
go with.
It does have a lot to do with consistency and like this compounding impact, right? And making something that is for the format where it should end up, like for the channel where it should end up, so that it actually resonates.
And I would say that's like, they're creating that content for their audience, who they clearly know, and not for themselves. I think if they're, this is the create, they're probably the great creator dilemma, right? Or even marketing, of like, you start out creating this content, and then you sort of get, you know, sucked in that world. Maybe that person like despises their life, but they're like, that's the lane they're in, and their audience loves it.
I think that's really interesting, like this difference between what you love and what your audience loves.
Yeah. I think ideally you can marry those things, but certainly if you're, you know, there's been plenty of content initiatives and things that I know nothing about this. This is not, you know, this is my job, but I'm not a medical expert. I have no idea what this is. This is not my passion. But I think for me, it's like, how do you tap into those stories where it's actually, you can make it interesting? Like, oh, cool. Like, this is the actual problem we're trying to solve for somebody. Here's how I can actually, you know, feel some empathy for them and understand their problems to make it interesting.
You've talked about the repurposing multiplier effect. Can you share an example where you saw one piece of content just explode in reach because you kept reworking it?
Yeah. And I think this is a perfect example too. I talked earlier about flipping the 3C concept method on its head. And so you can start with cut content. So you can create original content and spin it up into something bigger. I actually love using social and email and things like that to be able to get validation on an idea or a topic. So I actually had a piece of content where I just threw out a random LinkedIn post, and it was like 7 ways, you know, that I survive as a solo content marketer or something like that. And it took off, and I was like, cool, awesome. That's this week's newsletter. And so I wrote a newsletter about it and got a couple of responses. Awesome validation. I then took that and created a podcast episode off of it and did a solo episode where I talked about it, got a certain amount of downloads. Then I took that and turned it into a carousel for LinkedIn and got like 30,000 impressions. And so what ended up happening was it just off of 5 to 10 different iterations, because the podcast then got me video clips that I could then share out and all that, and I'm getting 361 times the amount of impressions that the first thing got. And so it's just that idea of being able to track the impressions over time. And I actually think, like, when I'm working with companies and things, it's far less about like that one piece of content and being able to track the repurposing multiplier. And it's way better to track those things over the month or over the given quarter to say, like, when we create a new video, we're averaging 10x return on the impressions based on that. And so I don't know if you have any questions on deeper, I can go on that. But,
well, I mean, when do you think you should be testing like individual smaller cuts, to use your word, versus starting with the cornerstone? Because it is, that I find interesting, that the interplay between the two.
I think it's kind of a mix. It's a little bit more of the art than the science side of it. Of if I know I want to post, you know, let's say 3 times a week on LinkedIn, for example, and I can say my cornerstone content is going to slot in one of those. Well, then I get 2 more opportunities to do something original. Or maybe I'm going to repurpose something else, but I got 1 opportunity to do something original. It's just trying to figure out what that is and then use that at bat, if you will, to be able to actually test a new idea, come up with a new topic, a new framework. It's honestly where I started testing things like the 3C content method, even like naming it and talking about it in that way, is like, that's how ideas become interesting, because you can instantly see if something is interesting to the audience or not, because you're going to get likes and engagement and reshares and all that type of stuff.
Let me just play this back. You would have the schedule for where the content's going to go and know that for the channel you're on, we'll say LinkedIn. It's like, all right, it seems like the best way to do this is posting 3 times a week, 1 newsletter a week, something like that. So then you're going to look at all of the content you're already making or say, okay, this is very obviously where I could put cornerstone content. I should take risks in these other two places. And that's going to be a good balance, because eventually one of these other two, some of them are going to take off, and I'm just going to repurpose anything that takes off into other forms. And so you just keep doing that. So you're constantly planting seeds, and then the plants that grow, you harvest them and you do more things like that. You graft them onto other plants. And
yeah,
that's the idea.
Yeah. The idea is you kind of build a flywheel of ideation and of creation. So I would call this like the distribution flywheel, is you are creating something that you have your channels locked in, but your topics can flow through any of those things. So if you have a podcast, I'm not going to do the podcast. Or if you have a blog, I'm not going to not blog this, you know, this week. This is what we do. We do blogging, we do newsletters, we do LinkedIn, whatever it is. We do YouTube. But then slotting in those topics into those things is what's going to be able to allow you to test and iterate. And it's just the lift is, it takes way less time for me to write a LinkedIn post than it does a newsletter, or a LinkedIn post than it does to record a whole podcast episode and see, is this going to land? I also get way less validation in a podcast. It's great content. I can see who downloads it. I can see those types of numbers, but I can't really get the feedback in the same way as somebody being like, this is amazing. Give me the framework. How does this actually work?
What do you think is your most unconventional take on content today?
That teams make way too much stuff. People are wasting way too much time creating things because they're hoping something will take off. And so I think there's a real delicate balance in all of this, but I think a lot of times people fill up time with creating because it feels good and it feels like we're doing something, and that being busy makes us feel productive, and therefore we're, you know, helping out the team and all this stuff. But I truly think, I actually wrote about it this week in my newsletter, I truly think if you took a step back and did an audit, you could probably slash 80% of what you're doing and get by. You would just have to get more out of what you were creating. And it would also force you to really think about what the heck are we making, rather than just sort of throwing caution in the wind and create. Because, I mean, the internet does not need one more random, horrible blog post. Like, it just really doesn't.
That's a clip right there. Let's talk about burnout with content. So you referenced it earlier, but like content burnout is a real thing. What do you think people should do if they're feeling like that's happening to them? Like if they're burning out when they're making content?
Yeah, I'll give you a great example. So for 2.5 years, I put out a weekly podcast like a maniac, and then I got burned out and I was like, forget that. I'm going to do it every 2 weeks. And I said, forget that. I'm going to do it once a month. And so I think the moral of the story there is you can decide. You have the agency as the content creator or even the marketing department. You really do have the agency to change what you're doing. You know, you might feel like you don't, but you do. On the more proactive side, I think understanding what you're trying to accomplish, that matters. It's the content we're creating aligning to a specific business goal that we're trying to achieve. Because if you're just trying to like get a bunch of traffic, you're going to have a really hard time, especially in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. Like, it's not the same game. And also at the same time, if you're just like, hey boss, we're building an audience, that's also going to be really hard because, hey, we've got sales we need to hit this quarter. And so it's finding that balance and what you can do and what you can do to move the needle. But I've always found like the best thing you can do is to get alignment. If you're a content person or whatever, get alignment with leadership in terms of what they're trying to tackle. And as long as you're in alignment with them, like you're going to be in pretty good shape.
So be as intentional as you can be about the content that you're making, that it's really working for you. So it's kind of like do less, but do the right stuff. And then set expectations the right way so that it's much easier not to get burned out, where it's like, all right, like, yes, we need to look at this over the month versus the day. We need to look at this over like how many unique pieces of content we make and then how much we get to repurpose it and create guardrails around it so that it's not something where you feel like there's just like a never ending list and you have agency to change that list.
Yeah, because where a content marketer will get burned out from most of my content marketing friends and folks that I've consulted with is you're just the people pleaser. Like you're just the people pleaser, like sales comes to you and wants this, or you know, CS needs that, or product team needs this. And hey, you also have to do all this other stuff that's part of your normal marketing job. And you're just immediately drowning in what you're supposed to be doing. And so I think being able to work within those, and it's much easier said than done in some companies than others, but be able to work inside those confines to be able to, like you said, I love the idea of setting up guardrails and being able to come to leadership and being like, hey, like this was our plan. I'm getting this outside request. Like, what do you think? Like, should we do this? That's going to mean shuffling something else. Because I think that's the hard thing for a lot of folks is it's that ability to move something else off the plate or down the line or into the backlog rather than just stack another brick into the backpack.
I love this. Let's talk about AI. I feel like we have to talk about AI. How can we not talk about AI?
It's required. It's required.
It's required. It's one requirement of any podcast done in 2025 is you always say, what about AI? So what about AI? I'll say, how do you see it fitting into this like repurposing? Where is it going to be helpful? Where is it not?
I think it's been a massive change in repurposing. And again, anybody who's played with AI, I just want the asterisk caveat of like, you know, you can't just like create me a blog post off this podcast. Like that's, don't do that. But you can absolutely create a blog post off a podcast way faster or a newsletter way faster than ever before. And so I actually use AI to create content. I'm not like one of those marketers who's like, hey, never. I only use it to ideate. Like, oh, I'm so much higher and better. I only use it to create topics. I don't write anything with it. You know, I would never. I would never do that. Like, it's all me all the time. I promise. No, of course not. Like, I create a podcast to repurpose everything else I'm doing. I actually created a custom GPT that allows me to get 80% of the way on. I can just load up a clip and it like spits out an awesome formatted LinkedIn post for me just based on my voice and tone and how I write LinkedIn content. It's amazing. It's also awful depending on what you prompt it, but it's incredible as far as how fast you can get things out. I mean, just for example, like we did an email. I was working to create a new email series. And we had all these blog posts, all of this different stuff. And I'm telling you, I created a 15-part email series in a matter of a week and a half to 2 weeks. That would have taken months in a previous world. Months. I mean, start to finish, brand new PDF, all of the stuff. Email series comes off of it. You can get this checklist. It's great. Running. We, you know, got 100% more downloads off of it month over month. Amazing. Would have been impossible to do in that time frame without AI.
Yeah. So use it well.
Use it well. Don't be. I would say, yeah. Don't be afraid to use it. I would actually say, like, almost try to break it if you can. Like, I'm actually to the point now where I'm like talking to AI. I use the dictate in ChatGPT, and there's different things, but it's so much faster. I can just talk to it and tell it exactly what I want, spits it out, and we can go back and forth. And I think that ability to be able to do those things, the ability to help you create strategies and plans as somebody who's like in a strategic role, incredibly helpful. Having it be sort of your gut test and say like, here's the plan that I think, like, what do you think? Like, be hard on this, like, help me refine this. How is this going to be better? Rather than just using it as sort of like a yes man.
Yeah, I love that. And that's right on with my experience too. I mean, I use AI a ton, and I think what it does well with is nuance, actually. So like, mm-hmm. when you're getting in there and asking questions, like, ask the nuanced, detailed version of the question, and you're going to get a better answer than if you don't. But also, you have to be a human and judge and edit and decide which things you actually like and which things you don't.
You sure do. And again, like, I think some AIs are better at writing than others. And so, like, you just have to be aware of, like, I was even looking at some stuff the other day, and I'm like yelling at ChatGPT, like, you keep giving me the same format. I told you to stop giving me this format. Like, don't use it. You know, or like, you know, it's like, it's so smart and yet so dumb all at the same time. It's wonderful.
That's great. Justin, is there anything we missed today? Any other questions I should have asked you?
Oh gosh. Probably a million things, Chris. You'll have to have me back on at some point, but it was super cool to be able to chat around kind of where B2B is at and with repurposing and distribution. And I would just say, like, overall, I think the landscape has changed. I'm seeing more conversation around these topics than ever before, certainly way more than the last 5 years. I think AI is also helping spur some of that conversation. But I think more so than anything, people need to really think about, with repurposing and distribution, how are you getting across the ideas and the stories and the marketing messages that you want to get across? Not just how are you repurposing clips from a show.
Perfect way to end. Justin, thank you so much. Where can people connect with you to follow your journey, learn more, ask you questions?
Yeah, absolutely. Hire me. Yeah, you can absolutely hire me. If you want to just connect and hang out, I am on LinkedIn. You can just find me at Justin C. Simon, I think is my actual handle. But if you search Justin Simon, I'm there. You can, if you want to connect and hop on a call or something, you can hit me up at justinsimon.co or sign up for my newsletter there as well.
Amazing. If you want more episodes like this, hit subscribe and check out our conversation with Scott Clary. It's a great follow-up to what Justin just shared.
Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia. Hosted by Chris Savage, produced by me, Sylvie Lubau, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham of Edit Audio. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.